Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin, and once again today we have with us Dr. William Dembski discussing a paper he recently published in the journal IEEE Transactions on Systems Man and Cybernetics, Systems and Humans, titled Conservation of Information in Search, Measuring the Cost of Success. In the previous podcast, we talked with Dr. Dembski about how this paper applies to the ability of Darwinian searches to solve search problems and actually whether or not new information can be generated through Darwinian processes and what this paper is all about. We're going to talk more in this podcast with Dr. Dembski about what exactly his paper is trying to do. So thank you very much, Dr. Dembski, for coming back on the show with us.
Glad to be with you.
Well, Dr. Dembski, you talk about whether or not these evolutionary algorithms are modeling the real world of biology. And you also write in your paper that, quote, hill climbing algorithms require a smooth fitness surface uncharacteristic of the feature selection problem, unquote. Many evolutionists obviously would have us believe that Darwinian evolution is simply a hill climbing exercise akin to Richard Dawkins' climbing Mount Improbable, where it's very easy for evolution to traverse these fitness functions. But do you think that fitness functions in the real world of biology are really just smooth hills, or do the actual fitness functions pose problems?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think what the paper establishes is that regardless of how one ends up representing these fitness functions and what properties they have, there's plenty of information that's being put in, certainly in these computer simulations of evolution, but also in the real world. But another question, which isn't posed in the paper, and essentially we're trying to concede to the Darwinist as much as possible, but there's a question of fundamental discontinuities as one is traversing biological configuration space. So, yeah, we can ask questions about how these fitness functions, what smoothness properties they have, but I think a more fundamental question is how continuous is this configuration space as we're going along, traversing it and moving up some fitness landscape? How far can we move before we can't move any further? I think there's this assumption within evolutionary biology that there's this continuity of evolutionary pathways and that basically you can go from one organism to any other organism. You might have to go backward in time before you go forward, but there's this assumption of common ancestry. And so you can basically move through this biological configuration space. But are there fundamental discontinuities in that space? So you've got a finch beak, and you're on the Galapagos Islands, and there's a drought, and the finches, if they're to survive, their beaks need to get bigger and harder to open the nuts, which are now dried out. And so you see some evolution there, and the finch beaks are getting bigger and harder. Well, fine, okay, but does that same process explain how you got the finch beaks in the first place, how you got finches in the first place? Okay, how if you push these evolutionary processes, how far do you go? And it seems to me that you can run into a wall. Fitness is going to break at some point, and you're not going to be able to do any evolution past a certain point. So I think this is, you mentioned my book, No Free Lunch. I mean, it was really a two-pronged attack. One was taking the line in this article, which is let's allow that there's full evolutionary continuity, how much information has to be inputted, but then also is there continuity and challenging that. And this is more along the lines of a Michael Behe irreducible complexity argument. But certainly the evolutionists, they tend to assume that these fitness landscapes are smooth, that can keep varying things gradually. And when we vary, let's say, some structural aspect of the organism, then function doesn't change very much. It may get better. And that these changes in structure and function, that they're going to be correlated, and that slight changes in one will lead to slight changes in another. But how do you test that? I mean, you can test it on small-scale level. And it seems that the only place where evolutionary theory really has been reasonably well tested is the microevolutionary scale. But when you start talking about smooth fitness landscape at a macro level, it seems that there's really no evidence for it. Just the nature of these fitness landscapes and getting some sort of empirical grasp of that seems to be pretty difficult. You know, but certainly we can represent these things computationally and work with them. But insofar as you're introducing smoothness constraints or you know, how many attractors do you have? How many places in biological configuration space might you evolve toward? All of that introduces information into the system. Fitness landscapes do not have to be smooth. With these attractors, there does not have to be just one, as with the Richard Dawkins example, where everything evolves towards me thinks it is like a weasel.
So, Dr. Demski, obviously one of the big questions about your paper is, does it support intelligent design? There's always a lot of controversy over peer review and intelligent design work. The claim that we hear constantly from ID critics is that ID proponents don't do research or that they do not publish in peer-reviewed scientific journals. And obviously your paper is from a peer-reviewed scientific journal. So how does your paper support ID arguments, and why is it relevant to the debate over intelligent design?
Yeah, good question. I think when critics look at intelligent design, often they get the sense that, well, intelligent design, that's about an intelligent designer, a.k.a. God. So we're talking some sort of supernatural influence, miracles, some sort of spooky cause and effect, which is beyond the remit of science. So it can't be science. And I think they get stuck in that sort of loop. And I think where this paper helps bring people out of that loop is information is a well-understood, well-worked concept in science. Information theory is a well-understood, well-worked theory. Information theory talks about information sources. And when you look at information, and what you do, I mean, because this arose out of communication theory, what you're doing is you're moving information from one place to another, which means that you can also backtrack it. And the question is, when you keep backtracking information, where do you end up? You end up, you know, basically you can keep reshuffling information. I mean, when I'm at my laptop, you know, I punch in an email message. Well, it's text. It's represented as ASCII. Then it goes and it's on my computer, represented then with some bits in my memory. But then it gets transmitted. So I've got a wireless router, so it first has to go to my wireless router. Then it has to go into my modem. Then it has to be transmitted. It's all sorts of error correction that takes place. So there's this multiple realizability of the same information. The same information keeps it's moving around. It's the same essential information, but it's taking different forms. And so, you know, when you receive an email from me, Casey, you know, well, it came from me, went through all those forms, and where did that come from? Well, eventually, it seems that what happens when you keep asking, well, what's the prior information source, what's the prior information source? In our experience, where you end up is with an intelligence. In the case of the email from me to you, well, it's my mind. The materialist might want to say, well, we can understand your mind in terms of natural forces, but that itself remains quite speculative. So when we talk about information sources, it seems that when we push back far enough, and I think this is really the upshot of a follow-up paper that we're doing, is that you get a regress of information. See, Richard Dawkins and the evolutionary community, they want to explain complexity in terms of simplicity. This is the great free lunch of evolution, that you start off with a single cell, and here we are, you know, these wonderful multi-celled organisms. And that single cell came from some simpler chemistry. So it's always simplicity to complexity. That's the trajectory. And what we're showing is with these information theoretic ideas is that when we see information expressed, the information to express it had to be at least as great as what God expressed. And then finally, so that these information sources get richer and richer, and where do they terminate? They terminate in an intelligence, in an act of intelligence. And so I think this information theoretic approach, it gets rid of a lot of the spookiness associated with intelligent design. It still raises the question of an information source, which then can be ultimately identified with a designer. But it makes it just much more mainstream. Go to Shannon's original book on information theory. Look at his communication diagram, his schematic communication diagram. I mean, information source is right there. it's a legitimate scientific concept.
So if you can briefly tell us, what has been the response from critics thus far to your paper, or has there been much of a response so far?
Yeah, this is really amusing. I mean, because it actually has gotten quite a bit of critics. There's been quite a bit of activity. And the thing is, the paper itself and the ideas have been out for, I'd say, close to 2 years. I mean, it's taken a while. The paper itself has gone through various incarnations. But it's funny, having this, the majesty of peer review attached to it, suddenly it's being taken more seriously. And also some of the critics then feel the need to disparage it that much more. So it, in terms of serious discussion, I haven't really seen much of that. The closest is, I think I followed Joe Felsenstein, of all places, at Panda's Thumb, which has been more respectful than what one is accustomed to from the Panda's Thumb. But I think it's going to take a while for this really to get the attention it deserves. And this paper is not a standalone paper. The main emphasis is setting up an accounting tool. Okay, but once you have the accounting tool, then it needs to be applied, and that's what we do in subsequent papers, and also prove some fundamental theorems about how this information problem gets worse as one backtracks, and that's why you get a regress, which then pushes you to an ultimate information source, which then could, rightly in our view, be identified with a designer. But people don't have to go that way. I mean, they can treat this approach purely information theoretically, and they'd still be working in our camp and not in the Darwinian camp.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Dembski, for your time and explaining to us about your paper published in the journal IEEE Transactions on Systems, Man, and Cybernetics, Systems and Humans. And we really appreciate the work that you're doing with Dr. Robert Marks at the Evolutionary Informatics Lab, and we very much look forward to seeing your future papers and where they come out and what they have to say. So thank you so much for your time, Dr. Dembski, today.
Yeah, thank you, Casey.
Well, if you want to find this paper by Dr. Dembski and Dr. Marks, go to the website evoinfo.org and click on the publications page, and you can find the PDF of this paper. I'm Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast, signing off. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.